From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, April 4th through Friday, April 8th, 2022, it was a week of horrifying atrocities in Ukraine, the confirmation of a new Supreme Court justice, and intensifying partisan political battles. Get ready for a powerful hour of Black Belt Talk Radio, during which your tolerance for hearing different but legitimate points of view will be tested. We've got lefties, righties, and fence sitters. Please don't get angry. Just listen closely and maintain a degree of educated skepticism. We'll be joined by Kevin Casey with the Talkers' Top 10 Stories of the Week, along with Derek Hunter, Jim Bohannon, Walter Sterling, Arthur Idala, and Matthew B. Harrison, influential yappers from across the country with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices, sharing their observations and the feelings of their target constituents, with whom they do a daily dance of affirmation in a fragmented, noisy world where we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, heard coast to coast and around the world on great radio stations across the U.S. and the U.K. The past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media. Information's gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. Okay, here we go. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10 this week, severe weather and climate change tied with NCAA basketball. There were dangerous rainstorms and destructive tornadoes throughout Florida and the Southeast this week, taking lives and tying up air travel that created delays for thousands of travelers.
March Madness came to a thrilling end, with Kansas eking out a win over the University of North Carolina. Hope you all did well in the office pool.
At number 9, COVID-19. This is the lowest the pandemic has been tracked on the Talkers chart in over 2 years, but it doesn't mean the coronavirus is completely behind us. Medical authorities are watching variants and cases in other parts of our ever-shrinking globe. Dr. Fauci said he thinks there will be an uptick in cases of COVID-19 over the next few weeks, and that there could be a surge in the fall. Meantime, massive lockdowns remain in place in Shanghai, China.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was diagnosed this week as having contracted a case of asymptomatic COVID-19. She was joined by Attorney General Merrick Garland and Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo, as well as several other prominent Democrats, including Representatives Joaquin Castro of Texas and Adam Schiff of California. Many of these officials attended a D.C. Gridiron Club dinner.
At number 8, a three-way tie between big tech, social media, and mainstream media. The big buzz in social media this week was Elon Musk's purchase of a 9.2% stake in Twitter, making him the platform's largest individual shareholder and bringing up questions about freedom of speech, along with wild speculation and unfounded rumors about what this will mean for former President Donald Trump, who has been banned from the platform.
In the world of mainstream media, there was also a lot of conversation as well as controversy about White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki joining MSNBC as a correspondent after she leaves the administration.
At number 7, immigration. Texas Governor Greg Abbott announced that the Lone Star State will send willing undocumented immigrants to Washington, D.C. by bus and plane, saying local leaders in the state are fed up with the federal government for releasing migrants into their communities.
According to Abbott, the plan is a response to President Biden's announcement that the federal government will be lifting a pandemic public health order next month, the result of which could significantly increase the number of immigrants crossing the border. The order known as Title 42, put into effect by Donald Trump when he was president, has blocked most migrants from entering the U.S. and for more than 2 years.
At number 6, a three-way tie between crime, race relations, and Florida's Don't Say Gay law. Crime stats in America's urban centers continue to rise or simply remain high, driving political backlash by voters in both the Republican and Democratic parties.
Arguments over the teachings of critical race theory and the handling of racial matters in general on the school level continue to be waged in communities across the nation, not to be outdone by the brouhaha in the Sunshine State over its new Parental Rights in Education Act, which puts a limit on teachers being able to openly discuss their personal lives with early grade students in regards to their sexual orientation.
At number 5, the Senate Supreme Court confirmation tied with the Hunter Biden investigation. The U.S. Senate's narrow confirmation of Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson as the first African-American woman to sit on the high bench has also sparked a racial component to the national conversation.
Meantime, on the political front, the federal investigation into the allegedly shady business dealings of Hunter Biden keeps turning up new developments and promises to the president's chagrin not to go away soon.
At number 4, partisan politics tied with the 2022 and 2024 elections. And the Hunter Biden affair is just the tip of an iceberg of accusation, attacks, and counterattacks between the parties as the Republicans look to take back the House, the Senate, and eventually the White House in what they hope will be a red wave of backlash against the Democrats in the coming midterm and presidential elections.
And of course, former President Donald Trump remains a central figure in GOP politics.
At number 3, the January 6th committee. And the spotlight of scrutiny on the former president concerning his role in the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol continues to intensify as the investigation grinds on. And the FBI and Department of Justice are now looking into classified records and documents that allegedly made their way to Mar-a-Lago, the former chief executive's private club and home in Palm Beach, Florida.
Not to mention his problems with ongoing local investigations into his operations, New York Attorney General Letitia James asked a New York court to hold Trump in civil contempt for his alleged refusal to turn over key documents related to the accusation that he misrepresented the value of his assets to secure favorable loan terms.
At number 2, the economy. Although the government reports a significant drop in the rate of unemployment, the lowest in years, the good news has been offset by the rate of inflation, causing an alarming rise in the price of gasoline, food, and housing, as well as the general cost of living.
Some of this is due to the pinch on the American economy being imposed by U.S. sanctions on Russia.
And at number 1 this week, the Russia-Ukraine war and U.S. foreign policy. News reports from Ukraine continue to shock the world as it witnesses horrific atrocities, murder, and mayhem being perpetrated by Russian missiles, bombs, and soldiers upon hospitals, schools, residences, and civilians, including innocent men, women, and children.
The conflict is causing American foreign policy to take on a level of intensity in terms of its dealings with Russia, China, and their handful of allies, not seen since the darkest days of the Cold War. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Let's kick off the interview segment of this week's program by visiting Talkers Heavy 100 radio talk show host Derek Hunter of WCBM Baltimore. So, Derek, there's so much going on in the world. What have you guys been talking about this past week on your show?
Well, there's a lot going on with the Florida law, the parental rights in education that is big. There, it's wildly popular. Polling shows even among Democratic primary voters, it gets about 65% approval rating. But Democrats have thrown in their lot with the remaining 35% and Disney. And it's one of those cultural issues where there's not a lot of gray area. And I think, Michael, people look at it and go, look, I don't care how people live their lives, but don't talk to my 5-year-old about how you live your life. I don't know how it was when you went to elementary school, but I wrote about it this week in my town hall column that aside from their last names and that their first names were Mr. or Ms. or Mrs., I didn't know anything about my elementary school teachers. I didn't know their first names. I still don't know most of their first names. And when you ran into them, maybe at the mall or at some sporting event or some random grocery store or something, it was like spotting a deer in the wild. You're like, wow, there's Mr. Duffy. Yes. Oh my, he's a real person. He eats food. But now for some reason, there is this compulsion on behalf of younger teachers to need validation for so much of their lives and through the children that they teach and refer to them. And I almost just did as their children, but parents being one who thankfully child isn't in school yet, you go, they're not your kids. Like you teach them. There's a difference between them being your kids and them being your students. And I think parents hearken back to the days that I've just recalled where Mr. Duffy said what you were going to learn that day. Mr. Duffy didn't have any input on what he did that weekend. I didn't know that I thought maybe he was hermetically sealed in his closet in his classroom until Monday morning or something. And people like that.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, I'm thinking back to my own childhood, which predates your childhood. And it's true. The teacher was a mysterious figure who was a teacher. And we, first of all, we had enormous respect for teachers. We were afraid of teachers. They had authority over us. And if you did run into one in the public, it was like spotting a unicorn. It was like, and they're a real person, or you see them outside of their attire. They might be dressed, you know, casually. There was a whole different angle on teachers. You know what I think? I think that what we have got to come to terms with in this country is what are the tenets of historic and journalistic objectivity? How do we teach our children what they need to know? Critical thinking, facts, reasons, philosophy, theory, all of the things that go into education without it crossing the line into political bias or something that would be extremely offensive to somebody else. This is not easy. Because again, when I was a kid, we didn't think about that. I mean, I knew when they taught us that Columbus discovered America, I knew that wasn't true. How could he discover America when there were Indians there? You know, there were certain things that just didn't make sense. But there was a little bit of wiggle room. You just understood it. Today, it's not the same. Would you agree that the search for objectivity is a gigantic challenge for us to remain a nation with any kind of public school system?
Well, you have to get over there's a certain percentage of the population that craves victimhood, and nothing will ever be enough. And there is no objective truth. It is my truth. It is your truth. There's no such thing as my truth or your truth. It is whatever time it is right now. We are wherever we are. It's not, I'm not in Paris. I'm in Maryland. But I can't sit there and go, you know what? My truth tells me that I'm in Paris. Now, no, reality is different. There is one agreed upon reality. And if we can't get to that point where we just go, well, this is an objective truth, then there's no way to teach it. And I'd much prefer teachers teach children how to think rather than what to think. I remember, and I'm a weirdo, when I was a kid, one of my favorite courses in high school was geometry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are going, oh, my God, what's wrong with this guy? A lot. But that's not the point. I loved proofs because it was a logical thing. You had something you had to prove if you could. Mm-hmm. And you had to go through all the steps to do it. And that class, more than just about anything else I learned in history, which I certainly use more frequently, but the skills to do those proofs, to look at a problem and go, I have to solve this problem, have served me more and better than anything I learned in college.
Fascinating.
Than anything I learned in college.
I had the same experience. I always did better in the arts and history and that type of thing. I was okay in science, but I really had trouble with math. However, the one area of math that I excelled in, amazingly so, was geometry. And I often think about that to this very day.
It's problem solving more than it's math. Mm. Algebra, I could do the equations. Calculus, you lost me because you're making up symbols and stuff. But the act of problem solving, I had dyslexia, so I was bad in English.
Oh, gosh.
Anything that required reading. But except in history, when I heard something, I could remember it. I loved history. I was good at the arts. I was really good at problem solving more so than math. But it's a skill set that you learn. I've never had to build a cabinet from scratch and really break out the geometry.
Mm-hmm.
But the way of thinking, the way of looking at a problem and going, I have to solve this problem, and here's how I'm going to do it, or at least try multiple different ways, comes from geometry. Algebra has never served me, and calculus I still look at it as a waste of time, but geometry.
Algebra was summer school for me. Calculus was one of my few academic disasters. Speaking of numbers, what are your thoughts about the economy and how things are playing out?
Well, there is a reality that is harming Democrats, and they are in the unenviable position where they either have to acknowledge what's going on with inflation or try to confuse people away from it. They've gone a third route, which is try to convince people they don't know how well they have it, which is a tough case to make. Republicans just need to kind of sit back and go, here's the facts. You're going to drive past the gas station today. That number is $2 higher than it was when Joe Biden took office. Democrats have to try and tell you, yeah, but still, and convince you of that. Economically, it depends on who you are as an individual and how you've been impacted. Some people have been definitely impacted by inflation, whereas other people who, say, have a mortgage that's locked in at a low rate haven't been yet. And you're never going to get anywhere by trying to convince people they don't know how well they have it.
That's Derek Hunter, the mid-morning host of WCBM Radio in Baltimore. Coming up next, a conversation with nationally syndicated Talkers Heavy 100 superstar Jim Bohannon. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. One of the great bands of the golden age of album rock, Gun Hill Road, has been around for more than 50 years. The members of Gun Hill Road are Steve Goldrich, Paul Reich, Glenn Leopold, Brian Coonan, and yours truly, Michael Harrison. I wrote the lyrics to a song on our new album, What Year Is This? It's titled, I Know You're Real. It's about the relationship between human beings and our friends in the animal kingdom.
I know you're real.
Take a moment to write down the following web address to see the music video of this inspirational song that contains some wonderful animal images that'll rock your heart and soothe your soul. Here's the address. Write it down. IKnowYouAreReal.com. That's IKnowYouAreReal.com. If you love animals, you'll feel real good after seeing this video. IKnowYouAreReal.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. The number one topic on the Talkers chart continues to be the Russia-Ukraine war. It ties into everything from the economy to our deepest human instincts and has significantly altered the course of U.S. foreign policy with Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, not to mention our NATO allies. Joining us now is nationally syndicated talk radio mainstay Jim Bohannon. You mentioned earlier, and certainly a very important part of your life, is that you are a veteran of the U.S. Armed Forces and that you did serve in Vietnam. We're at a time now where there's a war in Europe, and it's very much sort of a throwback to wars of the past. A lot of people thought maybe those kind of wars are gone with tanks marching over, you know, tanks and troops rolling over borders and countries taking over countries and buildings being bombed. And there is a certain level of atrocity attached to this Russia-Ukraine war, obviously. But what is your view of just war and armies and military from the 60s and 70s when you were in the Vietnam War to now where you're a commentator on such wars as that which we've had in Iraq, Afghanistan, and now the war that we're very close to being connected to between Russia and Ukraine?
Well, first of all, I think that I've seen enough to say that, frankly, a conflict is part of human nature. We have, over the course of decades, centuries, millennia, advanced to the point where it's not an automatic fallback, but it's always there. It's always a potential course of action, and I don't see that that changing any more than I see humanity changing. In fact, I'm not even sure that would be such a great idea. Are there ways that we could improve humanity by, let's say, tinkering with the human genome? Yeah, there probably are, and who knows what we might do if we did that. So I am not even suggesting that we do that. Even our warlike tendencies, it's there, it happens, and therefore civilized societies that like to think of war as something beyond the pale, something beyond their course of action except as a last resort. I think that we have to be ready, always ready. The notion that you can reason with the unreasonable, well, frankly, you go back to 1938 and Neville Chamberlain waving his little piece of paper, peace in our time. Well, all he did was embolden Adolf Hitler by letting him carve up Czechoslovakia. Hitler decided, well, Chamberlain and the British and the French and the others in the West, they're not going to do anything. So Poland, here I come. And there has to be a recognition of human beings, and that is there are always going to be bullies. Sometimes they're playground bullies with fists, and sometimes they're big-time nation-state bullies, and they have weapons of mass destruction. But you've got to be prepared to deter them. I think it's the main lesson that I learned. Did I enjoy my time in the Army in Vietnam? There were moments, and I still have friends, a few friends that I served with, but the overall experience, no, I didn't enjoy it, but of course it wasn't there for my enjoyment.
The fact that you're a veteran and the fact that you've served in the Army during a real war in our history, it doesn't seem to be part of your, forgive the word, shtick. It's not something you talk about. You're not looked upon as some guys, you know, they wear their military history as one of their identifiers. You know, I'm a veteran and I was in the war. And you don't do that often. Is there a reason for that?
Well, I don't think that my experience is all that unique from my age group. Once we got past the military draft and a tiny subset of society served in uniform and in places of peril, I think that may have changed. But, I mean, I didn't consider my experience anything unique. People ask, yes, I was a veteran. Yes, I served in Vietnam. No, we didn't kill babies. In fact, the Viet Cong did, as a matter of policy, kill babies. And I would explain that to people. But I remember leaving, for example, when I was home from Vietnam, still in the Army, and I arrived at the Oakland Air Terminal at about 2 in the morning, and we got processed out before dawn. And we were told, since almost every one of us had at least some civilian clothing with us, it would be better if we put the clothing on because of the protesters. I mean, we didn't fool anybody. Short hair, a deep tan. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. We were just tourists passing through San Francisco. But nonetheless, I can remember that notice. There were no people who gave you standing ovations in airports back then. So I don't ride on that. I served. I'm proud of the fact that I served. I wasn't a hero, but yeah, I did my duty.
That's nationally syndicated Westwood One radio talk star Jim Bohannon. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Let's stay with the Russia-Ukraine war for another insightful conversation. We're joined now by one of the radio industry's longtime thought leaders who's had a successful career on both sides of the microphone as both a talent and a broadcasting consultant. He hosts a weekly show titled Sterling on Sunday that approaches grassroots human issues from a down-to-earth, nonpartisan perspective reflecting the values of American family life. Walter Sterling. Walter, the war in Ukraine has consistently been at the top of the Talkers magazine charts in terms of conversation on the talk shows in America now for a month and a half. And it's even made its way to your program. I know that you usually stay away from politics. Tell us about this connection that you've made and what type of impact it's had on you and your listeners and your own feelings about the war.
I think people get confused about what is politics. This is a situation that is a war. And that means that troops are coming into people's homes in the suburbs of Ukraine and raping their children. Well, that's not politics. That's a war. 2 weeks ago, I had on a Ukrainian on the air on my show on Sterling on Sunday. And the Ukrainian is a native of the Ukraine, lives with his parents, and is a banker. He's a regular, normal guy. And he came on Sterling on Sunday to discuss daily life in Ukraine now. And this is what we learned. First, we learned that the bombs go off every night from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. nonstop. And he said that is not a police action. That is war. And then he talked about seeing 9 and 10-year-olds abused, beaten up, and raped. And he said that is not a police action. That's war. He said, you cannot imagine the depth of horror that we are living through. And I asked him, how is daily life? Can you open the bank? Can you go to work? Can you drive a car? And he says, it depends on the day and it depends on the level of bombing. But this is nonstop. It's a fear campaign. Everything that they can do to keep us in a state of fear, they are doing.
And now for our listeners here on the Michael Harrison Wrap is a brief excerpt from the conversation Walter Sterling had on his show with Ukrainian Andrei Duradesky.
Russia changed their military tactic, and now they just covertly bombing civil citizens, civil cities, from ships that are situated in Black Sea and from territory of Crimea. They don't care what be military objects or it would be civil hospitals, schools, shelters. For example, today at 6 a.m. they attacked my city from air. Partially rockets were shot down from our militaries, but three rockets at morning hit the refinery and the sky painted in orange color of sunset, and in a second the whole city woke up at the moment from vibration, broken windows, car alarms. The sun turned in completely black, which did not let in a single ray of the sun. Have you seen the photos from the city of Bucha, Kyiv region, which was liberated by Ukrainian army a couple of days ago? These photos, civilians with their hands tied behind their backs and bullets in the back of the head, civilians who just riding bicycle to home.
My impact from this is the same as anybody's would be, which is that I'm horrified. I was horrified at the concept of this war before I talked to this man. It is much worse now. The most interesting thing about the conversation with this Ukrainian is the level of fear and horror and authenticity in his voice. You can hear how scared he is, and then you can hear the bombs going off in the background in his suburban home.
When I was a kid, I'm a post-war baby boomer, so we grew up knowing about the war. It was actually glorified in many ways in movies and television shows, the toys that we played with. You're a bit younger than me, but you probably remember in your childhood, World War II stuff was, it just permeated the culture. It wasn't like, well, that happened 5 years ago, 10 years ago, it's forgotten. It just, you know, went on and on and on. But I used to think about it, you know, they would talk about air raids, air raid drills, and sirens would go off, but there was never any backup. The bombs did not fall on America. We saw pictures of them falling in London. Edward R. Murrow used to broadcast from them and describe the scene and the terror. And we were spared that. It's very interesting that, you know, you're talking about the terror of having your community bombed. It is very scary indeed. And I don't know. We've had now generations of Americans who've never experienced that type of thing. You think we're soft? Do you think it makes us less than empathetic?
No, it makes us blessed. We're not supposed to experience that sort of thing. That's not how human beings are supposed to live. We grew up in a time when the war was over there. Pearl Harbor was over there. It was an abstract thought. It was an abstract thought until September 11th. And then the war was down the street. And my biggest concern raising children in Manhattan was that one day I was going to have to explain to them that the war was down the street, because they were going to pass the World Trade Center. They were going to know what happened, and it was right there. That's what they're experiencing in Ukraine now, which is that every part of that country, suburban, city, hospitals, schools, is being bombed right now. And what shocked me about what I learned from the Ukrainian is that the coverage is inadequate. The coverage from real newscasters and serious reporters and from diplomats and from all the official people is not saying what the man who lives there is saying. He says the bombs start at 10 p.m. every night and end at 5 a.m. every morning, nonstop, continuous throughout the country. I've not heard one correspondent say that, but it was very clear from the energy and the sincerity in his voice, that's what's going on. He also was incredibly grateful for the opportunity to say on American radio that this is not a police action, this is war.
You have three children of various ages, from grade school to high school to college. And one of the things you talk about often is your adventures, you and your wife, your adventures in parenting. And, you know, you have your finger on the pulse of younger generations. How have you handled the conversations about this Ukrainian situation with your kids?
I haven't done it with the 10-year-old because there's no reason for her to know or understand it. The 16-year-old learns about it in school and then talks about it with us. And the 19-year-old's at college. It's over there. It doesn't impact them the way World War II did not impact you and me. It's over there. You and I are introduced to it on an emotional level when we see it on TV, when we hear it on the radio. We have to absorb it, digest it, and try to understand it. The kids that I deal with, it is an abstract thought, and I'm very happy about that. I am delighted it's an abstract thought.
Okay, so this goes back to what you said a few minutes ago, that we shouldn't engage in conversation that the kids here are not tough enough, or they're engaged in frivolous thoughts, and they're obsessed with socializing and what their friends are up to and what they're going to do on the weekend and what kind of clothes they're wearing. You know, it's stuff that some kids in the world, say kids growing up in Israel, where you serve in the army and there's constantly war going on. When I was in Israel several times, I found it amazing how different the kids were. They seemed so much older than the kids here. So I gather what you're saying is don't fall victim to thinking that's a better way to raise kids. We're lucky and blessed to have the peace we have. But it is an issue that Americans talk about.
Well, it's nonsense. The reason that our relatives fought in World War II and Korea was so that our children could grow up this way, that they could grow up in a bubble of innocence and sweetness and the opportunity to find their lives without bombs coming down. Bombs are not supposed to be coming down. They're not supposed to be armed. There isn't supposed to be a gun at the door. That's not the way kids are supposed to be raised. That's not the way you and I are supposed to live. That was what the purpose of those wars was, that we could have the freedom to live in peace.
That's nationally syndicated radio talk show host and longtime media industry consultant, Walter Sterling. Coming up next, back by popular demand for the second week in a row, a real-life Perry Mason, Henry Drummond, Bobby Donnell, and Alan Shore all rolled into one. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap.
This report is brought to you by Genesis 2 Project, G2P. Recently, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the ODNI, released a preliminary report on possible threats posed by UFOs, now known as Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, UAP, and the progress the Department of Defense UAP Task Force has made in understanding any threats. Dr. J.C. Van Valkenburg is a former Los Alamos National Lab biophysicist who has been working with G2P to bring scientifically sound UAP data to the public.
G2P has released the first scientifically authenticated documentation of UAPs, including images captured with infrared technology. Primo Forensics performed the digital forensic analysis.
In tandem with the ODNI report, these data support the development of relevant processes, policies, technologies, and training for the U.S. military and government personnel upon encountering UAP. Visit Genesis2Project.com.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. Crime and justice continue to be hot topics on the talk shows of America and are playing a significant role in determining the course of politics and elections. A very special guest last week on my podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, is one of America's leading criminal defense attorneys. He's based in New York City and has been a regular go-to guy for legal analysis on all the big TV networks for years. He recently launched his own daily radio talk show on AM 970 The Answer in the Big Apple. By popular listener demand, appearing on the show for the second week in a row, here's an excerpt from the podcast conversation I had with Arthur Idala. Idala has represented such figures as Rudy Giuliani, Harvey Weinstein, Roger Ailes, and Alan Dershowitz. His latest high-profile client is Lauren Pazienza, the Long Island woman charged with manslaughter and the shoving death of Broadway vocal coach Barbara Meyer Gustern.
A couple of weeks ago, it was reported in the newspapers that a very well-known, very loved and adored 87-year-old vocal coach who's coached many of the Broadway singers, and I think Debbie Harry from Blondie and other very notable people, she was pushed on the sidewalk, and she fell and she hit her head and she was hospitalized, and days later she died. And the New York Post, actually a week ago today, put out pictures of the person who they believed did the pushing. And Saturday morning, pretty early on, I was trying to do family time. You know, I try to put the phone away, but I received a phone call, actually a message from a high-level city official asking me to call them. And that, you know, it was obvious that they're not calling to chit-chat on a Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. And I made that call, and I wound up spending the weekend with the family of my client and my client. And then I arranged for her surrender, which took place this past Tuesday. And it's really been a media frenzy this whole week. And then today, I went back into court and dealt with the media once again. And even right before I came in, I was a little tardy because she was released on bail today. And then there's all the other phone calls of, you know, where is she at now? And, you know, there's a balance that I have to strike. You know, my number one priority is my client, right? I'm a lawyer first. I'm always a lawyer first. Mm-hmm. And I have to shield my client if that's what the case calls for. But I also have a very strong relationship with the media for many years. I mean, but, you know, there's a balancing test between giving them what they want and giving them what they don't want. You know, you're not giving them anything, which often is what's in my client's best interest. So I'm always kind of walking that line by being polite while I say no to my friends in the media.
Yeah, well, in this case, this woman, this client of yours, is this a homeless person or a mentally?
No. She's look, first of all, the evidence, I don't have any of the evidence. Uh-huh. So as far as, you know, it's everyone is innocent until proven guilty. We don't know who was where and who did what. But no, she's a high school educated, college educated, has a job, has a fiance, supposed to be married, has a loving family, grew up in Nassau County, working parents, you know, a good person. So we're going to get to the bottom of what took place here and then figure out what we're going to do with the case.
Oh, well, I'll resist the temptation to turn this into a conversation about that. It's very easy to turn that
into I will tell you, Mr. Harrison, everybody has wanted to speak to me the way you're speaking to me right now. I mean, I've only spoken twice, on Tuesday at the court appearance and today at the court appearance. So you're the only one who got a little exclusive. Not that I said much, but
well, you said plenty. It's very interesting to hear this candid type of dialogue in the thick of the excitement that is just a normal part of your life and the responsibility you obviously have to other human beings. Now, when you're dealing with the press and the media, is there a point in which it's dangerous, perhaps, for the media to have too much information or to pay too much attention to, especially a criminal case, that it could taint the jury pool or that it's a rush to judgment by the media? We see so much of that today in today's hyper-communications era. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, it's always a primary concern. You know, you mentioned about tainting the jury, et cetera, et cetera. So I tried the Harvey Weinstein trial, right? I was part of that trial team. In that case, yes, the media coverage was just so overwhelming. I don't believe he could have gotten a fair trial anywhere, maybe on Mars, but nowhere on the planet Earth.
So much of law is such a big subject on television shows. You mentioned Law and Order, police dramas, and criminal law is so idealized and so glamorized and dramatized. I just wonder, you know, if you think that the average person out there who gets all of this or high profile cases has an understanding of what the law business is all about.
The best part that you said, because I've learned this from my colleagues, and I sum up when I speak to jurors, I say, you know how you know this isn't Law and Order? Because from the arrest to the verdict is not going to take 48 minutes.
Exactly.
Okay? Yeah. It's going to take 48 months, maybe, but not 48 minutes. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I understand what you're saying. That look, the drama is in these shows because the drama is in real life.
Yeah.
And you can say the same for the medical shows. You know, they're literally in the medical shows, they're life and death.
Absolutely.
What we do, and to some degree, is life and death. I can tell you, I represented a young woman named Bridget Harris. It was the biggest pro bono case I ever did. She was charged of killing her father. She dismembered his private parts, and he gagged on a rag that she put in his mouth because he was screaming when she did that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, she did that because he had been sexually abusing her, and then she was about to sexually abuse her niece. Cutting to the chase, we tried the case. As I said, it was all pro bono. I put my heart and soul into it, and we got an unbelievably positive verdict. And I remember calling my friend, who was a doctor, and saying, now I know what it feels like to save someone's life. And the drama was, I mean, the drama in that case was so immense, Michael, I misheard the jury. I thought they said guilty, and I checked that off the box on my desk and my colleague says, why'd you check off guilty? They said not guilty. I said, no, they didn't. They said guilty. And then Bridget, my client, leans over him and she goes, Arthur, they said not guilty. I'm like, are you sure? Are you guys sure? I mean, that's how freaked out I was. One other quick one was a crane fell in New York City on the east side. 51st Street and 2nd Avenue.
That was your case too, yeah.
Yes, it killed 7 people, including 6 of my client's colleagues. And it was a huge case. There was a new district attorney in Manhattan, Cy Vance. He didn't indict the case. Morgenthau did. It was Morgenthau's last case, big case, and it was Cy Vance's first big case. And when they read that verdict, and we heard, his wife is there, his 3 beautiful teenage daughters there, every crane worker in the city is there, they're all rooting him on. The courtroom is packed. I mean, it is right out of a scene of the movie. And we got to hear not guilty 40 times, and with the media snapping their cameras away, and I just looked at the court officer and I said, Jennifer, I said, can I go out the back door? She goes, sweetheart, you could go anywhere you want. And Michael, I went out the back door into the hallway, right behind where the judge left the bench, where the judge sits, and I see another door, and I open the door, and it is a broom closet. And I fell to my hands and knees, and I cried like I hadn't cried since I was 10 years old and crashed my bike into a tree and chipped my front tooth. The pressure, the anxiety, knowing he's facing 15, 20 years in jail, knowing his daughters are there, his wife is there, knowing in my heart that that man did nothing wrong that day. That's the worst feeling. You're representing a person who is factually innocent. Yes, the drama is real. That case probably took years off of my life. But then the satisfaction is like nothing else. I mean, it is a high that you cannot imagine and feel unless you've actually experienced it.
That's Arthur Idala, one of the best-known criminal defense trial lawyers in America. The conversation you just heard was excerpted from my podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, and you can hear the whole thing at mhinterview.com. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Speaking of lawyers, my son Matthew B. Harrison, who serves as producer of this radio show, is a media attorney and professor of law at Western New England University School of Law. You know, as far as I'm concerned, this whole thing with Musk is a blur, because Musk is a blur to me.
As I'm reading more about it, it's interesting. He's been planning this for a while. He has been purchasing shares of Twitter since the beginning of the year.
Do you think he has a motive? Because he hasn't been clear about it. He says that he is an absolutist about free speech. But that's kind of an extreme statement that even people that are strong, you know, devotees and champions of free speech understand that
there's a limit.
There has to be some type of a limit where intention to deceive steps in as a counterpoint to the concept of freedom of speech. It's tricky as to who decides that, but the whole thing of Section 230 is in play with this.
Totally, because it's who is responsible when someone has a lawsuit against something that gets posted. Is it Twitter who gets, because if they're not censoring anything, then, and they're just letting it go, then you can't hold them responsible. But if they do censor, which I argue they do, and they make editorial decisions, then they don't have that protection.
So it's your position as a legal mind, as a scholar, as a professor, that Twitter should not be given Section 230
That neither privilege. Facebook or Twitter or any of those companies, the big companies, that it's 230 is meant more for hardware companies, the companies that actually bring you the physical internet.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that a case could be made, and I know this is not your area of law, but it's law, do you think that a case could be made that that Facebook and Twitter and the social media platforms of that magnitude can be compared to the electric company, the water company, and public utilities, and cannot be given the free rein that a private corporation would?
Yeah, they balance somewhere in between a utility and some sort of independent corporation that follows a free market paradigm, because utilities are inherently going to be a monopoly situation where the pricing is fixed, and in theory you have a government or some sort of regulatory board that approves that and makes sure that they're not gouging, et cetera. But there's none of that for social media.
You know, our colleague, you know, Steve Wiseman, he feels that basically it takes technology. Technology breaks new ground, and then it takes the legislation or the law sometimes years to catch up. I don't know. I think the technology is still moving so fast. I mean, now we're getting into the metaverse that we may not see in our lifetimes. The law catching up to the advances in technology and the impact upon free speech, First Amendment, laws that protect people's reputations, fair use. But I cannot tell where Elon Musk is at politically. There are people who are saying that maybe if he has a say in matters, he's going to be on the board of directors. There are people wondering whether or not he'll get along with the current chairman and the other people there. Some people say the board has no power. Others say, why would he want to be on it if it has no power? But where he stands on Trump, a lot of people say, hey, put Trump back on. And especially if you're an absolutist in free speech. And yet it's unclear what he plans to do about Donald Trump.
It is. And there's also a rumor, the rumor mill is going crazy with the idea that somehow Twitter and Truth Social are going to merge.
Well, I'll tell you this, with all of the money and all the power and all the followers and excitement that surrounds Donald Trump, as of this moment, his Truth Social seems to be an abject failure. It is not catching on. And it just goes to show you how powerful the established platforms are, that somebody just can't come along and do a knockoff of Twitter, even with the following, the influence, and the resources of Donald Trump.
And Musk spent $2.6 billion to purchase over 73 million shares of Twitter. Like, that was not a small investment. Well, maybe to him, but in theory, it's as much money as it would be to start something from scratch.
Do you think that he's doing it for the money, or do you think he's doing it for the prestige, or do you think he's just doing it to mess with everybody's mind? I mean, I know you can't read his mind, but, you know, in getting ready to talk about this particular topic, which is one of the most talked about topics of the week, I find it very difficult to understand his motives. What do you think?
I'm not sure he necessarily knows all of his motives, or at least they change from time to time.
That's my son, Matthew B. Harrison, who produces this show in addition to teaching media law at Western New England University School of Law. And that about does it for this latest installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation, looking back at the week of Monday, April 4th through Friday, April 8th, 2022. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. The Michael Harrison Wrap. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications presented in association with Talk Media Network and Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2022, all rights reserved.